Welcome to everyone. Psalm 90 is the psalm that we're going to tackle tonight. This is a very interesting psalm in the way that it introduces. I guess before we begin, let's go ahead and just read the psalm together. Psalm 90, a prayer of Moses, a man of God. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world. Even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man back into dust and say, return, O children of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like a yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. You have swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep. In the morning, they are all grass which sprouts anew. In the morning it flourishes and it sprouts anew. Toward evening it fades and withers away. For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we have been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before us, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days have declined in your fury. We have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years. Or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. For soon it is gone, and we fly away. Who understands the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? So teach us to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Do return, O Yahweh, how long will it be? And be sorry for your servants. O satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days that you have afflicted us, and the years which we have seen. Let your work appear to your servants, and your majesty to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and confirm for us the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands. It is interesting that this is a psalm that is entitled A Prayer of Moses, the Man of God. You don't think of Moses being a psalmist. But in fact, there are many psalms that are not written by David. David wrote the majority of the psalms. There are many other psalms that have other authors. Solomon has a few, and many of the sons of Korah. If it is true that most modern scholars scoff at the idea that this psalm would belong to the prophet Moses, who lived many, many years, 1,000 years before the psalms were compiled. And while these titles were evidently not original to the psalms themselves, there really is no good reason to doubt their truthfulness. In fact, it is really interesting as we go through. And I'm not going to go to these passages, but it is interesting to make some comparisons between Psalm 90 and Deuteronomy 32 and Deuteronomy 31, 33 as well. Of course, Deuteronomy is a book where Moses is giving his last farewell to the Israelites before he dies. And many of the themes that you find in Psalm 90 are found as well in Deuteronomy 32. Just a very similar idea, God being our dwelling place, returning, asking the Lord to return to us, asking God to confirm the work of our hands. So if it is true that Moses wrote this psalm, then it would represent the oldest psalm that we have in our Bible, written about 1,500 B.C. This psalm, though, has three parts. The first part, verses 1 through 6, is a contrast between the eternal nature of God and the temporal nature of man. And verses 7 through 11 is going to be talking about how difficult life is, how dismal our life is, because it has been tainted by sin. But then finally, verses 12 through 17 is asking the Lord, just entreating the Lord, Lord, just make sense of all this. Help us. Help us in this state. We are in dismay. Help us in all of this. And so we're just going to go, very simply just walk through the psalm and talk about some of these different ideas. So first of all, Psalm 90, verses 1 through 6, you have this contrast. In verses 1 and 2, first of all, you have, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, you gave birth to the earth and to the world from everlasting to everlasting. You are God. He speaks of the everlasting nature of God. It's interesting, first of all, that he calls God Lord. It's one of the interesting things about, well, generally in the Old Testament, generally in the whole Bible, it's interesting to note how the writer is addressing God. There's several choices that the author has. And especially in the book of Psalms, as you go through the book of Psalms, it becomes very obvious that it is purposeful how the author chooses to address God. So, for example, earlier this morning, we talked about the book of Psalms being divided up into five different books. The first book focuses on God, but it focuses on Him as Yahweh, this is His personal covenant name. And so it's a lopsided. Sometimes instead of using the word Elohim or just a general word for God, it focuses on, it uses Yahweh almost 200, 300 times. But then when talking about Elohim, just a general word for God, it's like 15 times. So it's very definitely, there's this emphasis on Him being Yahweh. He is the God that brought us out of Egypt. However, when you get to the second book that is also written by David primarily, Yahweh is here only 74 times, whereas Elohim is over 200 times. So all that to say is that in the first book, there's an emphasis on the name Yahweh. In the second book, there's an emphasis on Him being God and Elohim. Now, what's the purpose in that? I don't have all the answers. It's just something that's really interesting, and obviously there's a purpose there. And so as you read through those books, making note of those will help us to understand, well, what is going on in the mind of the psalmist. And here in verse 1, when Moses speaks to God, he doesn't use God, Elohim, or Yahweh, the Lord in all caps. This is the Lord in lowercase. In other words, this is the word Lord as in the master, the one who is the Lord of my life, the one who has command over my life. He speaks to Him as the Creator. And so instead of speaking to him about, or as Yahweh or God generally, he speaks about Him as the master, God of creation, the God of this earth, the God of this universe. Everything is under His control, which is makes a lot of sense, especially when you read the context of the psalm. It's talking about God's control over man and control over our lives. I think it's significant as well. If Moses is indeed the author of this psalm, significant to see that Moses was one who could see God as Lord, as one who had control. Can you think of all the miracles that Moses witnessed with his own eyes? Passing through the Red Sea, changing water to wine, changing his hand from a regular hand to a leprous hand. Oh, we could go on and on about the 10 plagues and then all the different things that happened in the wilderness. What an amazing witness Moses is to the power and control of this God. He is in control. He is Lord. But He's not just Lord of one time or just the time of Moses. But He says, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. So first of all, talking about this idea of calling God the dwelling place or the refuge. It is God who is our dwelling place in all generations. This word means dwelling place or lair or refuge. Usually this is a word that talks about God, or sometimes it talks about God's dwelling place, Him dwelling in heaven. Or sometimes the scriptures talk about Him dwelling among His people. The thought of God dwelling among His people is frequent, and that in and of itself is just an amazing idea, that He would want to dwell among His people. But here, it is God Himself who is a habitation, a refuge. I think, again, that is especially impressive when you think of the life of Moses. Where was Moses' refuge? Where was his dwelling place? For the last 40 years of his life, where did he call home? He's just wandering. Going. There is no destination except going to the promised land. Could you imagine living a life like that? Where is my refuge? But in spite of this fact, Moses calls upon his Lord. It is a remarkable picture of a man who is a wanderer. He is a straying pilgrim, as we just sang, on earth. But with every step, he is home with the Lord. He is comfortable in his dwelling. But this is a dwelling that outlasts all others. We have houses. How long do those houses really, how long are they really going to last? If you've ever had a house and had to make house repairs, they are falling apart very quickly, aren't they? But God is a refuge in all generations, which means that He was a refuge before Moses. He was the refuge of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, of all men of God who put their faith in Him. In fact, He says, before the mountains were born, You gave birth to the world and the earth. You were a dwelling place even there. It's amazing to think of the expanse of time that He's talking about here. It's really hard for me to conceptualize these great length of times. After all, I've only experienced one lifetime, right? And only a part of that, in fact. But what Moses is talking about here are hundreds of years, thousands of years. And so he calls upon many times the mountains as witnesses, because those are the mountains that have seen the folly of men, like in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 4, that they see men, the generations come and the generations go, and there are the mountains still, and they laugh at all of our folly. But even these immovable witnesses have been born by our God. It helps me thinking about the expanse of time and the number of generations that have come and gone, to think of large cities. Maybe even a city like Jerusalem. And think about all the generations and all the activities that happened in that one spot. Can you imagine that? You can get out your list of kings. Maybe even sing the song in your head. And you can sing all the kings of... That's a lot of kings that lived and died, made laws, took away laws. But then these kings went away. A new nation comes. New people go away. Old people go, new people come. It's amazing to think how many kings ruled upon that one hill. How many armies must have ravaged her cliffs. How many people must have lived, died, worked, played for thousands of years, but it's still the same mountain. And so here are all these generations that come and they go and they die, they live, but God, instead, it says in verse 2, He is everlasting to everlasting. You are God. He is a God that does not change. He is master and will continue to be master. He is the great I am. He is the all-powerful. And he is the only true dwelling place for all of us. But that eternal nature is contrasted with man. Whereas God is eternal, he speaks in verse 3, he says, "You turn man back into dust. And say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight is like yesterday when it passes by. Only as a watch in the night, you have swept them away like a flood, and they all fall asleep. In the morning, they are like the grass which sprouts anew. In the morning, it flourishes and sprouts anew. Toward the evening, it fades and withers away." He speaks of the nature of man here. It seems like he, in contrast to the significant and eternal nature of God, it is contrasting with the insignificant and temporal nature of man. Verse 3 echoes the sentiment of Genesis chapter 3 and verse 19 when he says, "You've turned man back into dust. Return, O children of men." What are we? We are but dust. And when we die, we go back to the place where God has created us. As opposed to God who is everlasting, man's life is characterized by death and turning into nothingness. Verse 4 speaks of God's sense of time. 1,000 years is like a day for God. You probably recognize some of that text in 1 Peter. Peter quotes this, or in 2 Peter, Peter quotes this to show that for God, time doesn't mean what it means for us. That God can wait for 1,000 years, and it's like one day. One day is like 1,000 years. God doesn't run on our clock. And in fact, here it's even more apparent. He says in verse 4 that this 1,000 years not only is like yesterday when it passes by, it's like one day, but it's like one watch of the night. It's like 3 hours. Even less than a day. God blinks and we are gone. Verses 5 and 6 then pictures us that while time does not mean very much to God, time is enormous for us. We are swept away by this flood of time, this river of time. Imagine yourself as just a drop of water in this river of time. Just one drop. And then you're gone. Waiting for the next generation. Waiting for the next people to come. And God sees all of this. We are insignificant. The years pass by and we only occupy one drop. Do you feel small? That is definitely the goal of the psalmist, to make us feel small, insignificant. We bloom for a brief moment, just like the grass, and then we're gone. Have you ever considered how long you will live? I think that's a thought that maybe a lot of us have been considering in these last few years. How long do you think you will live? Compared to eternity, even Moses died. Dying 120 years was like a blink of an eye. I am 40 years young this year. And if I calculate right, maybe I'll live to be about 80 if I don't fall off my bicycle too many times. But if I calculate right, that means that I have spent half of my life already. It's gone. I can't go back and reclaim it. I can't hold on to it. Some of you are smiling and saying, "Yeah, wait until you're 60 and start thinking about that. Wait until you're 80 and start thinking about that." But that is something that is, once you get to be about 40, that you start thinking about, wow, stop singing happy birthday. It is very sobering to think that my life is halfway done. That in a little bit of time, I will be gone and I will be forgotten. Do you remember who your parents are? Surely you do. Most of you do. Most of you have that blessing. Do you remember who your grandparents were? Do you remember your great-grandparents? What about your great-great-grandparents? What about their parents? I'm running out of greats. Who are they? What was their favorite color? You don't know anything about them. They're just a name. I have lived this life. I have bloomed. It's been great. But as far as this world is concerned, in just a little bit of time, I'll be a name. And so will you. Nobody will remember. That's very sobering. Could you get my phone? Thank you. You can turn off your phones, please. Don't answer that. But the briefness of life in and of itself is something to make us just... It's really sobering, isn't it? The briefness of life, the brevity of life. However, it's not just the brevity of life that Moses is contemplating. Instead, he's in contemplating not only the brevity of life, but also this dismal life that is affected by our sin, that is tainted by our sin. In verse 7, he says, "For we have been consumed not by time, we have been consumed by your anger. We have been consumed by your wrath, and we have been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence, and all our days have declined in your fury. We have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life that contain 70 years, if due to strength 80 years, yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. For it is gone, and we fly away. Who understands the power of your anger? For your fury according to your fear, for your fury according to the fear that is due you." What is he talking about here? He's talking about this idea that we're declining because of God's fury, because of God's wrath. It might be that we want to argue with Moses. Say, wait a minute, Moses, I don't know that I can say that God's, making my life dismal. This is just the way life is. I do think it is interesting to put ourselves in the shoes of Moses. And what is his life like at this point? He's walking around 40 years. What's happening to all of the people that he knows? They're dying. One by one, everybody that he knows, all of his family, Aaron, Miriam, all of his friends from the other tribes, all of the people who were the important people that he would associate with at the very beginning, those people that he shared so much with, they're gone. They're dead. And why? It's not just because life happened. It's because sin happened. You remember the story in the book of Numbers. The people of God did not believe in God and his ability to take them into the land of Canaan. So God says, you will not go into the land of Canaan. And so for 40 years, people were wandering around in the wilderness without aim, without goals, with only an idea that you were going to die. Could you imagine? Just the sadness of just seeing all of your friends one by one pass away. I think, however, when we say it in that light, that maybe we can see this with more general application. So I think some of us feel the same way. And it may not be because of sins that people have done, and that's why they are dying. But it is a sad thing to get up in years and start noticing that everybody that I knew is passing. I'm 40 years old. But these last 2 years, some of the people that have just been so precious to me are gone. And when I look at this congregation, Mike Dubose, other brethren, Brother Hart, others who I just associated, this is where they should be. And they're gone. And when we look at this, definitely we could say that this is not because of one particular sin that one individual did. This is just what is happening to our world. But let us be reminded that all suffering in some way or another is linked with our sin. Either it's my sin in particular. We can understand that. I go and I rob the bank, I get shot. That happens, right? Or it might be that my neighbor sins and he runs a red light and hits my car and now I have to suffer because of it. It may be that my father sins and I have to deal with all of that. It may be that the people in the world sin and I have to deal with that. But generally, you know what? We are all in the same boat. All of us are sinners. All of us are dealing with suffering. This great world that God has created, in fact, suffers at the hand of sin. And the psalmist attributes all of this suffering and this punishment and to the punishment and the curse of God. In verse 11, he says, "Who understands the power of your anger and the fury according to the fear that is due you?" Our God is a powerful God. These verses really remind me of, in verse 12, and these verses really remind me of some of the thoughts that you have in the book of Ecclesiastes, where we're just here for this brief moment, and what has been the point? This is such a difficult life to go through, and then we're done. We're here for 70 years, we're here for 80 years. Sometimes we quote that kind of in a comical way. Let's see how, but the point is not comical at all. The point is we're here for just a brief time. And then we're gone. We have our pride for a moment and then we fly away. Who can understand the power of God? If we just think of it from this point of view, life is dismal, isn't it? Is this what led the writer of Ecclesiastes to say, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity"? There is this great emptiness when I've lived all of my life only to be meeting the hands of death. An even greater emptiness when I have to watch my loved ones suffer and die. I'm tired of the pain. I'm sure many of you are as well. God is our only refuge. And really, that's how Moses ends this psalm. Moses is tired. And so he asks finally, "Lord, just make sense of this life. Help us to understand. Help us to make something out of all of this pain and this difficulty that we're going through." In verse 12, he begins and says, "Lord, help us, first of all, teach us to number our days. Give us wisdom." He says, "Teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom." I think the idea that he has here is help us to number our days. Help us to understand how brief our life is. You really don't appreciate something until you know that it's limited. Can we appreciate that? If someone thinks that he has all the money in the world, give him a credit card. He has no stop to how much he's going to spend, right? Until comes the bill and he sees, oh, there really is a limit on how much I can spend. And when someone finally understands that, he starts purchasing then with wisdom. Moses asked God, teach us, Lord, to number our days. Teach us to walk with wisdom. What would be the idea that we will use each of these few days that we have in goodness and honorable things and things that count? It's very similar to the thought that you have in Ephesians chapter 5. I'm going to just real quickly take us over to Ephesians chapter 5, connecting some ideas here. In Ephesians chapter 5, and in verse 15, he says, therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time. Or some of your Bibles say, redeeming the time. Not as unwise, or because the days are evil. It's very similar to some of the thoughts that you have in Psalm 90. Teach us to count our days. Because what we are going through, the days are evil. There's so many things going on. Making this, and so then do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. How do we walk as wise men? There's many ways to answer that. But the understanding what the will of the Lord is part of this. Teach us to number our days. But also he says, Lord, return to us. He says in verse 13, do return. And here he says, O Yahweh. He uses the covenant name. Yahweh, how long will it be? And be sorry for your servants. Oh, satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness that we may sing for joy and may the glad and be glad all of our days. Make us glad according to the days that you have afflicted us and the years that we have seen evil. What is he calling God to do in these verses, verses 13 through 15? He's asking for God's mercy, isn't he? Give us some relief in this time of affliction. Give us gladness. Give us, he uses the idea of joy and gladness in all of these days. I think it is interesting in verse 13 that he talks about the idea of, oh, do return, O Lord. Earlier he had talked about him calling the people in verse 3, return, O children of men, return to the dust from which you have come. He is calling us to the dust. Now we're calling God before we turn into dust. Return God to us. Be with us. Be our refuge. Give us relief in all of this time. Christians are susceptible to the very same pains that everyone in this life have to go through. But we have a God that promises to help us. To help us to understand. To help us to make it through. In verse 16, he also says, let your work appear to your servants, and let your majesty and your majesty to their children. What is he asking for here? Well, the work of God. What works has Moses seen? The miracles that he has done in the past, his workings, however he's going to be working, he is going to be active in the lives in their eyes. Lord, be involved in our lives. Be involved also in our children's lives. Be a part of this. Don't leave us in our suffering. But then finally he says, and look at the play on words here as well, in verse 16, let your work appear to your servants. But then in verse 17, let the favor of the Lord be Lord our God be upon us and confirm to us, for us, the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands. So while we ask God to be involved in our life, to help us in our struggles, to be our refuge in all of this, we also ask, God, let the work that I'm doing here on this earth be something that is significant. It's interesting to me when Moses writes this. I wonder what was going on in his mind. At what time was he writing this? Was it at the very end when he's about to die and he writes this psalm? And then he writes this psalm saying, confirm the work of my hands. May what I've done in this life mean something. I wonder if he would be surprised that thousands of years later, we're still talking about Moses. Still talking about his example, his faith, and the things that he has done. In reality, who was Moses? He was nobody, wasn't he? And compared to the things of this earth and all the different things, if you ask a historian, what artifacts can we use to find who Moses was? It's nothing. But because God was behind this man and behind the works that he did, God confirmed the works of Moses' hand. I just think that is just something interesting. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder what will happen after I preach a sermon. How long do people actually remember that sermon? I'm gratified if the next day someone comes up and says, hey, thanks for the sermon. I remember that you preached yesterday. If a week later goes by and someone says, you know, I have some notes that I took of the other day, someone said, I have a note in my Bible that said David Rafe preached right here. I have no idea what you said, but I remember that you preached right there. Okay, well, that's something. But it's really interesting to think about just even the things that we do here. What is the purpose? I preach and I touch the lives of some, but then all of us, it's just very, very little. But maybe that was the same feeling that Moses had. He touched the lives of those who were there, but I can't go into the promised land with everybody else. I want to go on, but I'm stuck. Lord, confirm the works of my hands. I think this is amazing to think then as well about the work that you do and the influence that you have may not be an influence on just the people around you, but also on the generations that come. When you are with your kids, don't think of them as just your kids, but think of them as the patriarchs of a nation that will come from them. You have a huge responsibility to set things straight in the beginning, to teach this one child who will have children. I can't control that. You can't control that. But God can confirm the work of our hands. Just some applications very quickly, but while we finish all of this. Number one, that sin results in suffering. Sin results in suffering. We never should be angry at God for the suffering that happens in my life, especially when this suffering is because of my own folly. Suffering is the result of sin. And this life, even though we have to deal with disease and we have to deal with things that are just part of this life, God did not mean for us to die. He meant for us to live for eternity. But why is it that we are dying? It's because of sin. And life and suffering, in reality, when we just look at the life and suffering or bury our hand and our head in the sand here and forget about God, it's meaningless without God. We can suffer, we can live, but there is no meaning unless we have our God and our Creator. But it is God who puts meaning into my life. He puts meaning into my life with the purpose of something greater, something that I can't touch. But one day I'm a straying pilgrim. But one day I'm going to cross that river and I'm going to go to some place where there is no pain and where there is only life eternal and joy and purpose. This life will drag you down if you just think about this life. But God calls us to the next. But besides calling us to the next, he also tells us that what we do right now does make a difference. And in his wisdom, he has said, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And what you do now will cause and have eternal effects in the lives of others. I hope that when we look at Psalm 90, that yes, we feel the despair of life, but also we see the purpose and joy that we find in God, our Creator. I pray that we can see that there is such great purpose in God, and that only in Him we have purpose. And as we sing the song that has been selected, I hope we will think about that. And if there's a way that we can pray for you or talk with you more, that we can be an encouragement of you, we'd encourage you to come and stand with us as we stand and sing.